Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. In the fall of 2019, journalist Grant Hill got into a cab. It was late at night, he was tired and a little drunk after a night out with a friend. The cab driver was very chatty and wanted to talk. He introduced himself as Clyde Ashley Sherman, but said everybody called him Sherman. He asked Grant what he did for a living, and when Grant said he was a reporter, Sherman said he had just the story for him. It was about a black physician named Gary Davis who developed a treatment for AIDS in the early 1990s. Sherman had worked with the doctor, helping him file paperwork.
But then when he told me what I could do with the medicine, positively help humans.
Sherman said the doctor's treatment could have saved millions of lives, but the doctor died suddenly, without this treatment really taking off. When Grant got to his destination and was getting out of the cab, the driver told him, "You have to get this story out into the world."
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
You can prove it to the world.
Absolutely, man. Absolutely.
Grant didn't know what to make of all this, but he was intrigued, curious, and he started digging, looking for information, making calls.
Hello?
Hi, this is Grant. I know it's kind of weird, you know, just me contacting you out of nowhere.
He ended up spending the next 2 years following this trail, and what he found is a story that spans decades.
Bobby Cowan is dying of AIDS.
Continents.
They're doing clinical trials in Africa.
And stretches into the innermost circles of power and fame.
And, you know, I wanted to get it to Magic Johnson right away.
It's a story about one man's passion to cure AIDS, but beyond that, it's about medicine, trust, and who has access to the scientific process.
Yeah, with all due respect, they were not successful. We scrutinized the data.
We're about to release a whole podcast series that tells this story. It's called Serum, and on today's show, we'll hear an excerpt. We'll also talk to a researcher who was there for the early days of the HIV epidemic, and we'll meet a couple that found love during this time of crisis and loss. To get started, let's stick with Serum and the story about Gary Davis, a black physician from Oklahoma. He died in 2007, but when reporter Grant Hill set out to learn more about Davis, he was able to retrace some of the doctor's life and steps. Davis went to medical school at Dartmouth and then returned to his hometown of Tulsa, where he became a pillar of the black community, often treating patients for whatever they could pay or for free. As HIV started to spread in the 1980s, Davis watched helplessly as patients died from AIDS. There was so little that doctors could offer. He became consumed with wanting to treat this devastating illness. He started to do research with antibodies from goats to tap into their immune response to the virus. And he created a treatment, a serum, which he eventually started to give to patients, even though it had not yet gone through any clinical trials. Back in the 1990s, some of those patients were speaking out about their experiences in news reports. Let's listen to this excerpt from Serum. Here's reporter Grant Hill.
This is how I came across the story of a 7-year-old girl from Washington, D.C., and her determined mother, both in need of a miracle.
7-year-old Precious Thomas,
Rocky
she
Thomas.
Was enrolled in two studies or
Rocky
protocols.
Says she tried to talk
One
to health officials at the NIH about the serum.
In the late 90s, Precious Thomas was, in many ways, the face of childhood HIV. She had contracted the virus prenatally from her birth mother. Not only had she taken the serum, but she declared on TV reports that it worked. Precious had to be nearing her 30s now, but despite all that past exposure, I couldn't find her anywhere online. But I did find her mother, Rocky. We started messaging and planned to talk in person. By the time our schedules lined up, the world had changed. We were a month into the lockdowns brought on by the COVID-19 pandemic, so we settled for a phone call.
Hello.
Hey, Rocky.
Hello. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking the time to talk to me today. Sorry for all the
technical
baby you're hearing in the background is Rocky's youngest daughter. She's 2 years old.
I have another baby. I had her since she was 2 months, too.
All in all, Rocky says she's helped raise 13 children. She officially adopted two of them. Tell me about how you first came to adopt Precious. How did that happen?
Her mother was friends with my aunt. My aunt basically lived in a crack house.
Precious was born in the summer of 1991 to a biological mother who struggled with drug addiction. She lived in the same place as Rocky's aunt at the time. And soon, Rocky started looking after the newborn.
Maybe a week. Then the weekends added up to a week and 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks.
By the time Precious was 2 months old, Rocky had made arrangements with her biological mother to take care of the baby permanently. Then, only months later,
she got sick when she turned one.
Fevers, thrush on her tongue. This is when Rocky found out Precious was HIV positive.
AIDS wasn't talked about.
Precious was quickly admitted to DC General Hospital in a ward with other HIV-infected infants and babies. Some had been abandoned there.
And, you know, some of the babies nobody would ever go see or anything, so she was on a ward like that.
The custody agreement for Precious wasn't formalized yet. That meant Rocky couldn't make any decisions concerning her health care.
I went to the court while she was in the hospital and did a petition for me to get her so she can be treated.
She didn't think twice about the road ahead. Rocky formally adopted Precious. From then on, Rocky and the little girl's doctors tried everything to help her, one drug after another, with varying degrees of failure. But at a time when many with HIV were ignored or judged, Precious wasn't.
Her story went public, leading to headlines in suburban Washington, D.C. newspapers, appearances with celebrities, even a visit from President Clinton.
So what was Precious like as a child? I mean, like you said, she was pretty sick from the beginning, right? So, like, how did this shape her life as a kid?
Well, even with her being sick, she was a smart child, very smart.
Rocky says Precious wasn't afraid of attention. She became an activist, started connecting with others who were positive. Soon, a friend suggested Rocky apply with the National Institute of Health to allow Precious to participate in trials with experimental drug treatments. She got in.
That was so much medicine, oh my God.
Some of this is documented in old news stories.
For the last year, Precious has been monitored by doctors at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland. She was enrolled in two studies or protocols.
One didn't do anything at all.
It requires intense monitoring while patients receive injections to boost the immune system and pills to drop the viral load. That's the amount of virus detectable in the blood. Though Precious never took the pills from the NIH protocol, she got sick from the few injections she did take.
When I came in the room, I had already packed the room. Packed up the room and said no more.
Then one day, Rocky heard about a doctor from Oklahoma who believed he had discovered a viable treatment, maybe even a cure, derived from goat's blood. So how did you first find out about him?
Channel 5 Fox had did a story on a man that was on his deathbed. From that segment, my phone started going ringing off the hook. People were calling, did you see that?
The news story Rocky saw was about a man with HIV who couldn't take the best new treatment options available at the time, like AZT, a 20-year-old failed cancer drug reimagined as HIV antiretroviral. By 1997, AZT and other recent breakthrough drugs had begun to reverse AIDS-related death trends around the country and usher in a new era of hope among those living with HIV. But the man on Rocky's TV set was not so lucky. His name was Bobby Cowan.
Bobby Cowan is dying of AIDS. He is also deathly allergic to the cocktail of powerful life-extending drugs routinely given most AIDS patients today. He has a very blunt way of summing up his dilemma.
You can't take AZT.
No.
You can't take protease inhibitors.
No.
If you do,
I die.
However, if you don't,
I die.
Take a deep breath.
Cowan's physician, Dr. Gary Davis of Tulsa, Oklahoma, has a treatment that he believes will help, maybe even cure Bobby Cowan. But it is so unusual, the Food and Drug Administration is banning the treatment.
In the news clip, Bobby Cowan wears a black sweater, a cowboy hat, large frame glasses. He's a middle-aged white man with a desperate look on his face. At the time, HIV was claiming thousands of lives in the U.S. every year. Those living with it were fighting a disease that was shrouded in shame and fear. They felt ostracized by society, ignored by their government, or even belittled. This is a recording from 1982. The mysterious illness had already killed about 600 Americans then. And a reporter asked President Ronald Reagan's deputy press secretary, Larry Speaks, about the disturbing trend for the first time.
Over a third of them have died. It's known as gay plague.
Yeah, that's laughter you're hearing. The reporter tried again.
No, it is. I mean, it's a pretty serious thing that one in every three people that get this have died, and I wonder if the president is aware of it.
I don't have it. Are you?
In other words, the White House looks on this as a great joke.
No, I don't know anything about it, Lester.
Does anybody at the White House know about this epidemic, Larry?
I don't think so. I don't think there's
nobody
been any.
Knows.
There's been no personal experience here, Lester.
No, I mean. I thought you were keeping...
I checked thoroughly with Dr. Ruge this morning, and he's had no patients suffered from AIDS or whatever it is.
It took President Reagan 4 years after the first known case to publicly utter the acronym AIDS on September 17th, 1985. By the end of that year, known AIDS-related deaths in the United States would climb to over 8,000. Congress allocated $190 million for AIDS research. But the wheels were turning slowly. There seemed to be very little urgency. Many argued that it was because the outbreak seemed contained within marginalized communities at the time. Gay men, black Americans, intravenous drug users, and Haitian immigrants. It was easy for the country and its medical establishment to turn away. So activists took to the streets to demand more funding, more support, and better options. Some went directly to FDA headquarters. Radical action was everywhere, die-ins, spectacular demonstrations. But the activists also collected research and data on the illness and potential treatments. One big demand was to be allowed to try new or developing medications and drugs that seemed to show promise for HIV. Right-to-try laws did not yet exist then, but people were pushing, fighting to try different treatments that had not yet gotten the stamp of approval from the government. Bobby Cowan was one of them, suing the federal government to be allowed to try Gary Davis's serum.
He wants the FDA to get out of his business and allow him to take the goat serum.
Look, I'm in a very unique situation. I have faith in God. I have trust in my doctor. And I have belief in the serum. Get out of my business. I'm living this. Washington, D.C. is not living this. The FDA is not living this. I go through this every day. I go to bed. I don't know if I'm going to wake up. I see Christmas. I don't know if it's going to be my last Christmas. And I have a constitutional right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And if I'm dead, I'm not going to be too happy.
I found the attorney who represented Bobby Cowan during this case, Jeff Nix from Tulsa, Oklahoma. He was working with Gary Davis at the time, filing paperwork to move the serum toward FDA approval. So he took on the Cowan case, too.
Bob was very quiet, just real respectful, just a really nice guy. And he was a biker, Harley. But it wasn't a Hell's Angel or any of that stuff. And I know he lived in a mobile home park out west. He's just very, you know, very ordinary working class guy. And his wife, they were just such nice people.
Nice people who were running out of time.
He had told me this, that he was so far down in the well that it was either a Hail Mary like Gary's serum or Bob would be pushing up daisies.
Jeff said he knew his odds for winning the case were slim, especially in such a conservative jurisdiction, but he wanted to try anyway.
the day of the hearing, the courtroom was packed with people who were advocates and who were supportive, black and white.
Jeff Nix and Bobby Cowan lost their first attempt in court, but they had other legal options they could still pursue. Meanwhile, over 1,000 miles away, Rocky Thomas had learned a valuable lesson from Bobby Cowan's story. This doctor from Oklahoma seemed to have something worth fighting for, and if she wanted to get her hands on this treatment, it would be better to ask forgiveness than to try to get permission. And it turned out, Gary Davis had heard of Precious too, and wanted to meet her.
This one particular person got in touch with Dr. Davis about Precious, and then Dr. Davis' staff got in touch with me.
We're listening to an excerpt from Serum, a new podcast series from The Pulse and Local Transmedia. It's reported by Grant Hill. It's a story about a black physician from Tulsa, Oklahoma, who developed an AIDS treatment in the 1990s. When we come back, Rocky manages to get Precious to Tulsa to see Gary Davis. And then...
he starts feeling better immediately. Go to sleep and wake up and a whole other person.
That's still to come on The Pulse.
The Commonwealth Fund supports The Pulse and reporting on health equity. The Commonwealth Fund, affordable quality healthcare for everyone.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're listening to an excerpt from Serum, a new podcast series from The Pulse and Local Transmedia. The podcast follows the story of Gary Davis, a black physician from Tulsa, Oklahoma, who was developing a treatment for AIDS in the 1990s. It was a serum made with antibodies from goats. He had not yet done any official clinical trials or gotten FDA approval, but word was spreading quickly among desperate and dying patients. Rocky Thomas had heard about the, quote, goat doctor, as he was called on the news, and she wanted him to treat her adopted daughter, Precious. The little girl had contracted the virus prenatally from her birth mother and had not seen success with any of the other treatments that were available at the time. Reporter Grant Hill picks up the story from here, after Rocky and Precious arrived in Tulsa after a long journey by train.
They sat down in his office to talk about the serum. Davis later told reporters that he wanted to explain why it might be effective for Precious.
She mainly wanted to learn about the procedure and what a neutralizing antibody was and how do you give this particular serum and what are the side effects. I've had 100 people, thousands. Asked me the same thing.
It was like sitting in the class. You know, we had tons of questions.
Rocky wanted to know how it worked. Would there be any side effects?
She gonna act like a goat. She don't want to eat everything. You know, he had his dry body racer and showing me how the antibodies worked and what it did to the goat. And it was a whole lesson.
Without FDA approval, Gary Davis said he wasn't ready to administer the serum to Precious. That would have been very risky and potentially have dire consequences since it hadn't gone through all of the testing. This was only an informational meeting.
He told me all the proper channels to go. I called FDA. I talked to Precious' attorney. But by me going through all the proper channels, Precious was still getting sick.
So Rocky took matters into her own hands. While Davis was preoccupied in his practice, Rocky quietly climbed a spiral staircase that led up to Davis's private office, where she knew he kept a batch of the serum in a freezer.
That's how it had to be kept, in a freezer. It was in a vial. Not a glass tube, but it had a screw on top.
Behind his back, she grabbed some and told no one, especially not Davis. But she later told reporters...
What did you do?
I took the goat serum. I took it and with the knowledge that I had, I did what I had to do with it.
You took it without the doctor's knowledge?
Yes.
I took it.
What do you mean you took it?
I took the serum.
You stole it?
I stole it.
Did you think about asking Dr. Davis?
He couldn't.
You asked him
for it? I did.
And what did he say?
He couldn't do it because it wasn't FDA approved.
It sounded a little improbable. Rocky's heist of the prized serum, her tiptoeing up a spiral staircase in the middle of a busy doctor's office to save her little girl. But that was her story, and she stuck with it for just a little over 20 years, until she told me what really happened during our phone call. Gary Davis was in on it the whole time.
He couldn't administer it to her because it wasn't FDA approved. He couldn't administer it to her, but I could. Turn your back. You don't know nothing. Turn your back. I'm going to give it to her.
So you told him to turn his back, and you went and got the serum.
I sure did. You ain't giving me nothing. I'm not trying to get you in no trouble right now. I just want her to feel better.
After this reveal, it became apparent to me that Davis was good at bluffing, or maybe to put it a little more bluntly, lying. Here he is talking to reporters about his reaction to the theft from his office.
Why didn't you report this to the authorities?
I understand the position. I don't agree with the methodology, but I do understand she wants to try to save her daughter's life.
So if Rocky's theft was a cover-up, what did that make Bobby Cowan and his one-man stand against big government? Why would Davis give the serum to Rocky, but not Bobby? The news reports of the time portrayed Bobby as a desperate, dying man fighting to get his hands on Davis's serum, his last hope, if only the FDA would get out of the way. But Jeff Nix, the lawyer from Tulsa, told me that while Bobby Cowan may have enjoyed giving Washington the finger, Bobby didn't wait for their approval. He was already taking the serum.
That's accurate. He was living pretty normally. He was eating pretty normally. He was a very slender guy. So, you know, he always looked kind of undernourished. But he was saying that he had gained weight. Just his general attitude was just a whole lot better. And his wife was just, I mean, she would almost get tears in her eyes when he would talk and she would talk about how much better off he was.
So why did Bobby and Gary Davis file a lawsuit?
We thought that it was possible that through the suit, we could get some sort of legitimacy to expand the operation and treat more people.
Jeff says Davis wanted to force the federal government to examine his work, to give the serum a shot. This way, he could scale up the operation without worrying about blowback from the FDA or state medical boards.
My dealings with the government have been limited, but I thought if we can get into settlement discussion, maybe something good, some sort of compromise that will allow Gary to treat people can be arrived at.
This makes sense in light of some other things Jeff Nix told me too. Jeff said Dr. Davis was somebody who cared deeply about his community and his patients.
He exuded a trust that was just palpable. And, you know, I'm sure you've run into people that you haven't been with them for very long, but you just go, I believe this person. And people believed Gary and people believed in Gary. And so I just really became a follower.
At one point, Jeff followed Gary Davis all the way to Washington, D.C. A sympathetic politician, Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee from Houston, had put in a good word for Davis and was able to get him a meeting with higher-ups at the NIH. Jeff told me he's never forgotten that meeting.
So we went to Washington to try to talk to NIH, and not only did we not get anywhere, but the director was just extremely hostile and made fun of Gary's disability. Gary's got a really bad back and limps, and I'll be damned if the guy didn't say, well, I'm going to look out the window and watch you come up our long sidewalk and just see how well you do. So that kind of set the tone. And sure enough, we got into the meeting, and the director said, oh, been there, done that. He walked out.
Do you think race played a role in how Davis was treated?
Sure. Absolutely. Absolutely. It was a black thing. The people involved were black.
Involved with the serum, you mean?
Yes.
So the lawsuit was basically a ramrod to open doors that were so firmly closed. That didn't happen. Jeff lost two suits in court. But it did spread the word about the serum. More and more people from the north side, the mostly black part of town, started coming to Davis, asking for serum.
And they left going, this guy's got something. We're going to do everything we can to keep him going, to keep him treating people. So it spread.
Sounded like, you know, quite a few came after that. It wasn't just one or two.
Yes.
So what happened to Cowan?
He continued to be treated. I continued to have some contact with him, and he continued to improve. It's funny, you know, as a lawyer, you come into people's story when it's already underway, and then you get out of people's stories before it's over. So after the lawsuits, there was no connection between Bob and me. So I just, there wasn't anything he needed, and there wasn't anything I thought I could do for him. So I totally lost touch with him.
With the story of the theft covering their tracks in the fall of 1998, Rocky and Precious talked more and more freely about the little girl's miraculous recovery, which Rocky says started right after she administered the serum to Precious in their hotel room in Tulsa.
She started feeling better immediately. When I say immediately, it was like go to sleep and wake up and a whole nother person. It was to the point where I had to yell at her to stop, and I had never had to ever tell that baby to stop doing nothing because she didn't have the energy to do nothing.
Rocky wrapped the serum in dry ice and stuffed it in her luggage. Precious was now well enough to fly. Rocky snuck the serum through airport security and brought it home. But soon, Precious was due back at the NIH for routine blood work. At first, Rocky was hesitant to tell the girl's doctors about the serum.
Even NIH saw a difference. Everybody that knew her saw a difference.
So you're going into the NIH at this point, a month later. Are you feeling nervous?
Yes.
Okay, so you're walking into the NIH, you're feeling nervous, and they take the tests, and what does it say?
Her labs came back, and they wanted to talk to me. It was like the team of doctors wanted to talk to me. And they took me in, and we were talking, and they said we had some good news.
Precious's viral load was undetectable. No sign of HIV in her blood.
And at this point, I'm in shock. I'm like, I'm just sitting here like, okay, I'm on edge. What's going on? Precious was in the toy room. And when they told me that, all I could do was cry. But in the meantime, nobody still didn't know. Nobody still didn't know.
Eventually, Rocky decided to tell them that Precious was not on any of the medications that they had given her, the NIH. Instead, she was using the stolen serum. She later told reporters about this.
Then what happened?
Nothing.
Rocky says she tried to talk to health officials at the NIH about the serum. She was hoping she could help Dr. Davis get his serum approved by the Food and Drug Administration. And what did they say?
They weren't a part of it. It was like nobody wanted to talk about it.
That's an excerpt from Serum, a new podcast series from The Pulse and local transmedia reported by Grant Hill. Serum follows the story of Gary Davis, a black physician from Tulsa, Oklahoma, who was working on a treatment for AIDS in the 1990s. What happened to the treatment? To Precious? What happened to Gary Davis? There are a lot of jaw-dropping plot twists in this story. Make sure you find Serum wherever you get your podcasts. We'll start releasing episodes on July 26th. Gary Davis was doing his research in the early 1990s, when treatments for AIDS were really just emerging. There were so many questions about HIV, a lot of confusion, rumors, false information, and fear.
During the early years, I remember how hard it was to have people, young people my age, with this horrible illness that all died. And there was really nothing we can do for them other than provide them care, compassion, and understanding.
That's Carlos Del Rio. He started doing research on the HIV virus in the late 80s. He says the people in this field were a small, dedicated group.
Almost every week there was new developments, there was new discoveries. And the people that went into the field, everybody was very interested and committed and really wanted to make a difference, right? To work together to deal with this problem.
Carlos is a professor of medicine, epidemiology, and global health at Emory University School of Medicine in Atlanta. He's also co-director at the Emory Center for AIDS Research. If you look back over the time since you started to where we are now, if you had to name maybe five of the biggest breakthroughs that got us to where we are now, what would they be?
Clearly, number one is the discovery of the virus, right?
Mm-hmm.
Number two, you know, would be the development of tests, a blood test for the virus, but also the development of the PCR technology that allowed measurement of the amount of virus in the blood and the measurement of the viral load. And something that people don't realize is that that infrastructure for PCR technology has been incredibly helpful now with COVID. We would have not been able to test the way we test for COVID had we not developed that platform that was used for HIV. I think number three would clearly be the development of effective antiretroviral therapy. And to know that effective antiretroviral therapy not only improves the life of people living with HIV, but actually decreases the possibility of people transmitting HIV. The fact that we showed that being undetectable equals untransmissible, that if you have your viral load in your blood is down to zero with medications, you don't transmit HIV. That's an incredible discovery. And that was actually called, you know, science breakthrough of the year when that was found. And then I would say the development of a pre-exposure prophylaxis, showing that giving HIV medications to people who don't have HIV prevented them from getting an infection. I think that to me is also a pretty remarkable development.
In the early days of the AIDS epidemic, there was a lot of pushback from people in the advocacy community who felt like the FDA was being too much of a gatekeeper in terms of what kinds of approaches were being tried, what was available to people. And I'm wondering if you can describe what was happening at the time.
One of the most transformative things that HIV did in research and in drug approvals was actually having the community involvement, right? And the community became very actively involved. And I think it was the result of, you know, the gay community had been fighting for their rights and had been fighting for their sexual freedom and sexual equity. And I think then, you know, they turned that into a fight against this disease. And the involvement of the community was such a critical part of what has been a success story. I think in no other disease has science, government, you know, industry and community work so closely together to achieve the goals. And I think a lot of the success in HIV is precisely because of that partnership with community. And I think that's an important lesson for many other diseases. And I will tell you that wasn't necessarily a love affair every time, right? I mean, the community pushed and the community was upset and the community was angry and the community asked for a difference. And the community, for example, you know, FDA required that all studies that showed that a drug was effective show benefit in survival. And the community pushed very hard to say we needed to find an alternative measure other than dead. And that's when all of a sudden, you know, viral load was developed and all of a sudden HIV viral load was accepted by the FDA as a surrogate marker for the effectiveness of drugs. And now that's how we look at the effectiveness of antiretroviral therapies, by its impact on viral load. So the amount of virus in the blood. So That was a gain of the community. And like that, there are many others.
How far are we from a vaccine? I mean, the vaccine has been mentioned again and again since HIV has been around.
You know, finding a vaccine for HIV has been, I think, one of the most complicated and humbling experiences that we all have had. And there's several reasons why this has been so hard. I think number one is that the virus attacks the immune system. it really destroys, that's why it's called human immune deficiency virus, because it makes a person immune deficient. It attacks the immune system. And the virus is continuously changing. So as your immune system produces antibodies against the virus changes into a different one that then evades the immune system. So there's continuous evolution of the virus inside the person's body that makes the immune system not be able to keep up with it. Number two, a difference from COVID, very few people, I mean, counted probably with a hand or less, have been able to be cured from HIV, right? So in COVID, you recovered. So we knew what an immune response was. We know how the immune system clears the virus. We know what the immune system does, what is the necessary place where the immune system needs to attack the virus, which is the spike protein, in order to prevent the disease and the attachment of the virus and the infection. We don't have that with HIV. In HIV, we still don't know exactly, you know, how does the body get rid of the virus? And that makes it incredibly hard to find a vaccine. So there's no what we call that in immunology, correlates of immunity. The correlates of immune protection don't exist. So it really is incredibly difficult. You're pretty much, you know, shooting in the dark.
And so it doesn't sound like the mRNA technology will change that.
It won't change it, but it will make the development of vaccine maybe a little easier. I have been involved in HIV vaccine research for many years, and I can tell you that it's a series of disappointments, right? It's a series of, oh, this didn't work, that didn't work, that didn't work. It's hard because the science looks good, the immunology looks reasonable, and then it doesn't work.
What do you hope to see in the next decade?
We all want to see a vaccine being developed and a successful vaccine. And whether that will happen in the next decade or not, you know, we'll have to see. But can we advance? Can we make progress without a vaccine? Absolutely. I think we can scale up much, much more pre-exposure prophylaxis, PrEP. And I think what is necessary is also that we address, in our country, we have to address the social inequities that are driving people to still get HIV, to still get infected, and to still die from HIV in this country. That should not be happening. And it's happening because of issues related to access, to stigma, to inequities, and to things that, you know, as a society, we should no longer be accepting. So my hope is that as we come out of COVID, we realize that health equity has to be front and center in all the work we do in public health.
That's Carlos Del Rio, a professor of medicine, epidemiology, and global health at Emory University School of Medicine in Atlanta and co-director at the Emory Center for AIDS Research. This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about the early days of the AIDS epidemic, a time of confusion, fear, and despair for many. Reporter Jad Slaman met up with two men who crossed paths during this time, but the specter of HIV pushed them to take very different roads in life, until they met again.
Robert Hooven has been out basically his whole life. In the 70s, he remembers there was a kind of ceiling to what you could be while also being gay and out.
If you're a young kid and you have some shitty job, you know, you can be out, and people were. But if you were an executive or you had a job like a doctor or something, I mean, you could be fired if they found out.
But Robert talks about this time with nostalgia, not bitterness. He says he sometimes feels for younger generations who maybe enjoy acceptance, gay couples on TV, but won't ever know anything like the community he knew, underground, devil-may-care, and tight-knit.
It was an old parking garage, and it was a huge, huge building. They put down 3 inches of sand on the floor of this garage before they put the hardwood floor, dance floor down, and cushioned it. So you could dance for hours and not get tired. Your feet wouldn't get sore.
He's telling me about a club in New York in the 70s. I sat down with him and his longtime partner, James Elliott, at their house near the Jersey Shore. You'll hear more from James later. The men remember the discrimination, the violence, but then there were the clubs. There was the way the gay community formed something like a chain of islands from Philly to Atlantic City to New York, where they could be their true selves while partying as much as possible.
Like 77, 78, 79, Philadelphia had their own version of Studio 54.
That is, if Studio 54 was an actual functioning church.
The pulpit was the DJ booth.
The men spent a lot of time in Philly, a city with a neighborhood now affectionately called the Gayborhood. Mere acceptance, though, wasn't enough for it to thrive back in the day. It also took a little help from the mafia, or at least that's what the rumor was.
And that's why the police left us alone. But, I mean, I can remember, like, Philadelphia would get raided all the time. And they had a whole system with blinking the lights and changing this and that. And, you know, you knew the cops were coming in, and then you knew they were, once they put the lights on, you knew they were in. So everybody had to get rid of their drugs, whatever it was, and get their IDs ready because you were going to get roughed up or carded or harassed.
It was an underground 24/7 party where all your friends were family, and there was always another club. By the mid-80s, though, it would all be ground to a halt.
Rumors were floating around in, like, I'd say as early as 79, beginning 1980. Things were starting to happen to certain people, and nobody knew what it was. A lot of people, even in the gay community, kind of dismissed it.
Dismissal would soon give way to fear, to confusion. There were even conspiracy theories.
But it's just like now. I mean, there was conspiracy theories back then about how the government gave it to us. They're trying to get rid of the gays.
Yeah, yeah.
Does it come from kissing, from touching a toilet?
People were getting spots and blotches and getting sick and getting respiratory and the pneumonia. And some people would linger on, and then they ended up living and looking like skeletons before they died. It was just hideous, horrible way to go. And it went fast for a lot of people.
Robert and James had met before all this, at a club back in 76. They say they weren't too serious back then. Had a few laughs, is how Robert puts it. When AIDS came on the scene, the two followed very different paths. Robert stayed in Philly. James got as far away from the epidemic as he could.
I knew the AIDS thing was coming, like he was telling you. So I didn't just abandon and say that. I went into the service. I said, I got to get out of here because I know that I probably would not have been a survivor, you know, because of the lifestyle that we were leading. So that and a couple other reasons I went into the service. I jetted out of here.
The Army became a kind of refuge for him, despite the fact that he could be involuntarily discharged if his superiors discovered he was gay. He would be back in the closet for the most part, but as he bounced around Europe and Asia from base to base, he would be safe from the virus.
I was out of the scene. I mean, I used to read about it and kind of nonchalantly throw it to the side because I wasn't in that world anymore, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I was in that world, but it was not like these guys. These guys had to survive this every day. I was playing the soldier routine.
Back in the States, the party long over, the deaths began piling up. Like many of the COVID deaths from early in the pandemic, they were often very lonely ones.
We went to the hospital, we snuck in, and everybody's walking around like with moon suits on, like, you know, completely covered up. And here's your friend laying there with no family. Get emotional. And you can't even talk to him, you know, like you just have to see him from behind. They wouldn't let you talk to anybody. They wouldn't let you in there. It was just horrible.
It was strict quarantine measures, and that meant no visitors, only family allowed.
You have now.
This person I'm thinking of had no family. He was thrown out of his house when he was 15. And we were his family, and they wouldn't let us in. So, you know, those are the kind of things that you can't get out of your head.
The grief of those days was unending. As we spoke, Robert is constantly telling me about people he remembered and then telling me their names and then telling me that they're dead. In all their grief, too, Robert says, there was always anger.
I mean, you're always mad. Like, it was sort of an age of activism. You got mad because nothing was happening and people were just dropping dead. I mean, literally dropping dead.
The so-called gay disease was easy to ignore.
Politicians weren't prone to support us. They just didn't want to talk about it. It's just like a family with the black sheep son, you know, like we just put him in the corner and ignore it and maybe it'll go away.
While James was in some far-off land, playing soldier, as he calls it, HIV would finally come to Robert.
I mean, I had a boyfriend back then, you know, but he wasn't feeling too well. And so we decided to go get tested. It was still like, you know, it was embarrassing at that point because now you were out of that comfort zone and you were dealing with straight people and straight people hospitals, and that whole world wasn't us. And but we had to submit to it because that's the only choice we had.
The results were just what he had feared most, HIV positive.
So, you know, they just told you, you know, and they said pretty much that, you know, go see your doctor, here's your results. They didn't really give you anything, any hope.
Treatments in the 80s were still in their infancy. The disease was widely considered a death sentence. Robert decided he'd head out west to California.
I thought I would just get away from everything and go and die, you know.
He didn't seek any treatment because he wasn't wasting away or getting splotchy like the others he'd known that died of the disease, but he was homesick. So after about a year, he moved back to the East Coast. It was a few years after his diagnosis that Robert would be reunited with James, who'd finally come home from the army. It was like their first meeting in the club.
So then I went out, I was here, I went out one night, he went out that night, and we, our friend Tyrone has passed away now, looked over and said, look who's over there, and it was him.
James didn't know Robert had contracted HIV, and Robert simply didn't know what to say.
You know, I just was scared to tell him because I really didn't want to lose him this time.
Oh.
And I was trying to figure out how am I going to tell him. Like, we weren't, like, having this big relationship yet.
He waffled, he waited.
And then my friend told him before I could tell him, and then he's like, well, why don't you tell me? I said, well, I was going to.
By 89, things had started changing a bit. As the pair tell it, people were still dying. But there were more and more examples of people living, of drugs starting to work.
I just accepted it. You know, it was like, it was a big deal, but it wasn't a big deal. You know what I mean?
Accepting it meant accepting that Robert was HIV positive. It didn't mean accepting that he wasn't seeking treatment. That had to change.
The one first thing they gave me, I had to take like 15 pills a day. And it was horrible.
It was a lot of trial and error in those days, and it was expensive. Robert remembers struggling to find work that had good enough insurance. Over the years, though, Robert's all-important T-cell count went up and up, from something like 5, nearly no immune function at all, up to the hundreds. Today, he works a government job with good benefits, takes a single pill, and like many with HIV and in treatment, the virus is so beaten back, it's often undetectable in his system. Robert has his health and the love of his life, but also there's the guilt.
Now, it's almost like a slow, like a low-level undercurrent that's always in your head. Like, I often think about all the people I know that passed away. Like, they're always there. It doesn't go away. You have that, like, low-level guilt. Like, why did I survive it, you know?
For The Pulse, I'm Jad Slaman.
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Earlier on, we heard an excerpt from our new podcast series, Serum. The first episode will be released next week. Make sure you find it wherever you get your podcasts. I want to say hello and welcome to our new listeners at WEKU in Kentucky. We're very excited to be heard on your station now. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, and Jad Slaman. Marcus Biddle is our health equity fellow. Our intern is Sarah Kirsten. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Nicole Curry is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral Health Reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.